Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello again, Buzzkillers. It's the old professor here. I'm back in London, flying back and forth across the Atlantic to get all these episodes in. Today, we're very, very fortunate to have with us Professor Richard Grayson of the University of London. And he's going to talk to us on a great subject that you may know very well, Buzzkillers. The Blackadder series that ran several years ago about World War I and how that relates to the truth and mythology of the conflict. Welcome, Professor.
Hello. Good to be here.
Oh, thanks. It's one of the most popular shows in recent British television history. It's certainly been popular in the United States as well. And I've been told that season 4, the World War I season, was the most popular season in the whole series. Why do you think that was?
I'm not actually sure that it was.
Oh.
No, I'm very much part of the Blackadder generation.
Right.
I was 14 when it first appeared in 1983, and you had series 1, which was set in a time vaguely associated with Richard III.
Mm-hmm.
It was revolutionary at its mm-hmm. time. The kind of language, the use of an historical subject, it came out of the school that produced Not the 9 o'clock News, which of right. course Rowan Atkinson was part of. And I remember that series very fondly. It's quite fashionable to knock series 1, but I think it's probably series 2 that's the most popular in comedy terms. Which was set in the Elizabethan period.
Right.
Series 3 was Georgian. Frankly, that left me a bit cold.
That was my favourite because that's closer to my period.
I was about to say I don't know of anybody who has it as their as their favourite one. With Series 4, it was widely watched. I don't know the viewing figures. It was widely watched, but it was really the final episode that was so much talked about.
Right.
Because it had a resonance that fitted with the kinds of things people thought they knew about the First World War, that they'd learnt at school maybe by looking at the poets, right. maybe they'd performed in Oh, What a Lovely War or seen it. That's a very popular choice for school drama performances. And I think it remains the case, or at least has remained the case until the last decade or so, that children at school in this country get as much about the war from looking at the poets and from drama
right.
as they do from studying history.
Right.
It is now a compulsory part of what we call Key Stage 3, which would mm-hmm. be essentially for 12, 13, 14-year-olds at secondary school. But I think what that series did was chime with a public view and reinforce a public view in a very emotional and engaging way, but also, let's not forget, a funny way.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And that's what we're here to talk about, the way it engaged the public, the way it engaged historical myths, historical realities. And I think one of the most fascinating things was early on in, I think it must have been in that final episode where Captain Edmund Blackadder has to explain to his underlings.
Yes.
They ask him how the war started, and he gives this long explanation.
That's right.
How accurate was he in that explanation? And also, how close was he to the kind of received notion at the time and the received notion since?
I think very close to the received notion among the public, but
right.
historically incredibly problematic.
Right.
You're right that it's in the final episode. If you look at what he says, it starts off with Baldrick saying, the way I see it, there's a war on, but there wasn't always a war, so how did the one state of affairs lead to the other?
That's right.
And he says,
typical
well,
Baldrick
do you mean why is there a war?
Yeah.
And what he says is this. He says, you see, Baldrick, in order to prevent a war in Europe, I'm reading from the script here, two superblocks developed, us, the French and the Russians on one side, and the Germans and Austro-Hungary on the other. The idea was to have two vast opposing armies, each acting as the other's deterrent. That way there could never be a war.
Right.
Baldrick then responds, well, this is sort of a war, isn't it? And then they go on and have a discussion, and Blackadder says there's a tiny flaw, which is that it just couldn't work. He uses he uses a phrase that we won't use here, I guess. But he's also earlier on, and I think this is where the fit with the general public view comes. He's also earlier on just said that the real reason for the whole thing was that it was just too much effort not to have a war.
Right. And that's and that you're saying is chimes well with the public perception of how the war started at the time and the public perception of how the war started as it's continued. I mean,
but look, if you look at causes of the Second World War,
right,
people can offer some explanation, which is about fighting Nazism, defending Poland. People usually bring in the Holocaust, although, of course, that's nothing to do with Britain going to war in 1939.
With the
First World War, the causes are, they are hard, even for historians, to explain.
Right.
Let's face it, there is no settled historical consensus on the war. We've had, just in the past couple of years, we've had Christopher Clark's The Sleepwalkers talking about really quite accidental and contingent factors. You've got Sean McMeekin's work, which really plays a lot of places a lot of blame at the door of the Russians, far more than is common.
Right, I
think insofar as there is a move towards an historical consensus now, there's a much greater blame placed on Austro-Hungarian militancy than there was. See, among British historians, that's certainly the case. And I think there's a slight downplaying of German guilt. Although, of course, back in the 1920s, there was very rapid treaty revision and a sense that maybe Germany had been punished too harshly.
So there are a sort of cluster of myths that go along with how it starts. And Blackadder's explanation for the beginning of the war really is the main one, akin to
the view that the troops were moving on the trains, and because of the train timetables, they couldn't be stopped.
Right. Yeah.
I think also even those people who were ambivalent about whether there was a war or not, and those who wanted one didn't foresee the kind of view that there was. Didn't foresee the kind of war that there was.
Right.
That wasn't what they were signing up for in 1914. Now, that's not to sustain another myth, which is that everybody thought it would be over by Christmas, because, for example, Kitchener's approach in raising the volunteer British army was very much that you're going to need a huge volunteer army, which is going to take a year or two to train, and it is very unlikely to be over by Christmas.
Okay, now that's very fascinating, because lots of people believe that that's the case, that the higher-ups had all thought and figured this out and it would be over by Christmas, and then that was part of their larger screw-up.
Some of them did. Some of them certainly did. But it goes together with the idea of war enthusiasm in 1914 that Katrina Pennell's written about very effectively. And what she shows is that the attitudes are very nuanced in Britain at the outbreak of war. This idea that people are lining the streets waving flags, well, they are. In some cases, but even those who are waving the flags have a mixture of emotions, uncertainty, fear, as well as some desire to send off the troops in good spirits.
Right, but in the news reels, you see what you see from the camera shots are the waving of the flag, and then the assumptions just go
exactly. And let's face it, a group of soldiers are marching through the streets. People don't know what the war's going to be like. What else are they going to do other than cheer them and give them a good send off?
Right,
they're not going to boo them or say, "Are you really very sure that this is a sensible thing, old chap?" You know, it's just not what's going to happen.
Yes, so at the very least, supporting the soldiers, the rank and file soldiers.
Exactly.
Yeah,
you know, it's and we know today the power of that support our troops message, you know, which goes through societies both in the UK and the US, and has, you know, made a huge impact on sports, for example.
Right, absolutely. Okay, that's an excellent sort of segue, or sort of a rebounding segue into what question that's always fascinated me. The depiction and descriptions of the British generals, Haig and others, in Blackadder, and how close that is to what historians believe now. Because I think Haig and the lions led by donkeys theory has now been sort of discredited. Haig being an idiot and
yes, exactly. Well, there's very little nuance in Blackadder.
Right.
So there are a number of ways in which General Melchett,
right,
who's really a proxy for Haig in some ways in this series, is portrayed as a very unflattering, in a very unflattering manner.
Right.
Some of this is just about general callousness. There's the episode Corporal Punishment, where Blackadder is actually sentenced to death in a court chaired by Melchett for shooting a pigeon.
Right. Shooting and then eating.
Shooting and then
cooking
eating.
Cooking and eating.
Yeah, and this is this fits a very strong view of harsh military discipline during the First World War. If you speak to public audiences, it's very common for people to talk about the thousands of men who were shot at dawn. Well, there
for
were
cowardice or
for,
desertion.
For cowardice or desertion. There were 346 men in the British Army shot at dawn throughout the entire war.
346? I've always believed the thousands.
Okay, yeah. So this is nonsense. Now, this goes along with other figures that are problematic. Again, public audiences will, if you say to a public audience, what proportion of those who served in the British military, by which I mean all the armed forces, during the war do you think were killed? And there'll always be someone who say, well, most of them.
Yeah,
I even had a member of Parliament say to me once, well, of course, there weren't veterans organisations in the interwar years because people didn't come back, did they? Well, the answer is that of those who served, it's not the lucky few who came back, but the lucky 88% who came back.
88%?
The fatality rate of those who served in the British military in the First World War is 12%. Now, you can add on perhaps another third or so who were quite seriously wounded, whether physically or mentally. But the fact is that 88% of those who served came back. Now, you will get exceptions to that in particular groups or areas. Mm-hmm. So, for example, some PALS battalions from the north of England suffered very high fatality rates. Even just on particular days. And the most dangerous place to be, particularly in the early years of the war, was as a junior officer. Mm-hmm. So you'll find that although there's this portrayal in Blackadder of a privileged upper middle class elite sending working class and lower middle class soldiers to their deaths, a fifth of old Etonians who served were killed. You know, that's nearly twice the rate.
Right. Eton being the famous...
Yeah, Eton, the famous private school.
Right.
And the same would apply to Oxford and Cambridge colleges, that by and large, these men were becoming junior officers. They're right in the front line. They've had a culture of bravery and leading from the front instilled in them. So this class portrayal that comes through in Blackadder is problematic. There are also other things about Melchett that are hugely complicated. In some ways, Melchett is consistently portrayed as being really out of touch,
right,
with the ordinary men. And the very first time we see him, he's introduced to Blackadder. And Melchett says, "Ah, excellent, short back and sides today, I think, please." And he just assumes that Blackadder has come to give him a haircut.
Yeah. Even though Blackadder is clearly another officer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. No, that's exactly the case. We also see a comedy aspect of him when, in the episode called Major Star, he manages to fall in love with with the lieutenant who's doing a drag act, and he mistakes him for a woman. And then when a woman eventually appears, he says it's a disgusting drag act. So he doesn't even seem to be able to tell men from women. But there are two occasions on which we see him talking about land gained. One is in the episode Private Plane, where he's shown a large map, which is a mixture of grass and earth. And Melchett says, "What's the actual scale on the map?" And he's told by Captain Darling, 1:1.
Right.
It's actually life size. This is the actual amount of ground retaken.
Which was about the size of a pool table, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was the size of a pool table. It was very, very tiny. In fact, it comes out as being 17 square feet when they mention it. This capture of ground is attributed to Blackadder's actions in the air when he briefly joins the Royal Flying Corps. And Melchett, having seen the land gain, says, "Well, Blackadder didn't die horribly in vain after all." Captain Darling says, "If he did die, sir." And then Melchett's response, and this is interesting, says, "That's the spirit, George. If nothing else works, a total pig-headed unwillingness to look facts in the face will see us through."
Now, that is fascinating, because that's often the depiction of these generals that were given in the popular media, in the popular press, even in, you know, his old-fashioned histories, that there was this blinkeredness, there was this belief in the overall success of the war, and they would overlook facts.
Exactly, and you see this in the episode Captain Cook, which is the other occasion on which battlefield tactics are really discussed, where Blackadder is invited along to staff headquarters to be briefed on a plan, and says, "Would this brilliant plan involve us climbing over the top of our trenches and walking slowly towards the enemy?" And Captain Darling says, "How did you know that, Blackadder? It's classified information." To which Blackadder's response is, "It's the same plan that we used last time, sir, and the 17 times before that."
Right.
And Melchett's response is, "Exactly, that's what's so brilliant about it. They won't expect us to do exactly what we've done 18 times before." Now, this is totally at odds with the learning curve that the British Army went through.
Totally at odds,
There were British generals who were more successful than others. But on balance, and Gary Sheffield's work has been very important in this, as well as other people who've written specifically about Haig, on balance, the British Army learnt as the war went forward. And you can see that even in the early stages of the Battle of the Somme compared to the later stages.
Mm-hmm.
So the gradual use, for example, of the creeping barrage.
Right.
So instead of firing off artillery for days, stopping, allowing the Germans to get back into their trenches before your men march forward, what you do is you have a creeping or lifting or rolling barrage, it goes under various names, where you fire on a precision basis,
mm-hmm.
and your men walk behind that, quite close to it. It's risky, but generally works. And the Germans don't have a chance to reestablish themselves in their lines before their attacks. Messines is probably, in June 1917, the Battle of Messines is probably the best example of where this works for the first time.
So, rather than pigheadedly doing the same thing over and over and over and going over the top, British generals are adapting to the different conditions of the war going on.
Very much so. Yeah. That's right.
Well, almost no. That's one of the biggest myths about the war that there is. No one thinks that. No one in the public thinks that.
Yeah, I think it's a real struggle to get that out there, because it doesn't fit with a particular view of the war that people have and seem to want to hold on to.
But I notice that you've been talking about how that view has been challenged a lot recently, particularly by scholars. Has the more correct view, the revised view, whatever, has that been trickling down into the public, into the schools at all, or anything like that?
I think fundamentally the schools don't cover it in enough depth, really, to debate the strengths and weaknesses of tactics. I'm not at all saying that schools are feeding the old myth.
Right.
but I think they're talking about things that, if you have a public context, it's very critical of the generals. It's hard to overcome. The sort of revisionist view, as it's called, has been out there for probably a good 20 years. When Gary Sheffield was talking about it publicly for the first time, and he talks about this in his book Forgotten Victory, he got hate mail about it because people just said, well, he was an idiot. And I had an incident at the Imperial War Museum where just over this past year, where there's a discussion of different views of Haig. And the final bit of this these slides on a tablet in the museum ends with something like, historians now take a much more positive view of Haig and other generals.
And that's it.
And
no detail.
Well, no, there is detail. That's the sort of summary point. A man standing there just said out loud to the person he was with, well, they must be idiots. You know, they're supposed to be clever people, but they're obviously idiots. And I knew he'd only arrived right at the end of this presentation because I'd been standing there. And I said, well, have you looked at the rest of it? You know, have you actually engaged with the arguments that there are about Haig? And he just did not want to know. And that's one person, but it's a very graphic example to me of how deep-rooted these ideas that the generals were incompetent actually were. But let's remember what people thought at the time. You know, this isn't historians making an argument that people didn't feel at the time. People around the world will know what a great outpouring of grief there was in the UK when Princess Diana died.
Right.
At Haig's funeral in the late 20s, there were more people on the streets for that than there were for Diana's funeral. It was a huge event.
Right.
Dan Todman has written about this in his book, Great War Myth and Memory. It was a huge event. Those who'd served in the army, by and large, saw Haig as a man who had led them to victory.
Wow, that's amazing, because you think of the depiction of Haig and Melchett, the fictional general, as being the impression that people had not only during the war but immediately after. But here you're saying 5, 10, however many years into the 20s, Haig is still remembered very, very fondly.
Exactly, yeah. He's someone that the men pay tribute to. And just think of, if he had been remembered so badly,
right?
Think of how people would have responded to the Haig Fund, which is what the Poppy Appeal was initially known as.
Those who don't know, the Poppy Appeal is the...
Well, the poppy, around the 11th of November every year, people make a donation to the Royal British Legion, which is a veterans organisation. Of course, they're no longer supporting veterans of the First World War. It tends to be far more modern wars. And you buy a paper poppy, which you want a plastic stalk, which you wear. And there's... It's a huge national event.
Right.
BBC broadcasters are virtually obliged to wear them while broadcasting during a period of about 2 weeks leading up to Remembrance Sunday and the 11th
very commonly
of November.
Worn, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's grown, I think, even in the last few years. But I remember as a child, even in the 1970s, they still said Haig Fund in the middle.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, that it was the Haig Fund. And Haig had set that fund up.
Wow.
As the really the figurehead of the British Army, and still in the and those who'd served in the 1920s.
So the Blackadder depiction of Haig really is very mythological.
Well, if Melchett is meant to be Haig, and I think we generally take Melchett as being a symbol of British generalship,
right?
Then yes, really, really tricky.
Okay, well, it's time for us to take a little break. Our first break of the podcast, to thank our Kickstarter supporters. As all of you out there know, because we talk about it every week, we wouldn't have gotten anywhere without Kickstarter. Kickstarter funded all of our equipment. Kickstarter funded all of our engineering fees and all of our syndication fees. Professor Grayson was very kind and generous and early supporter of the Kickstarter program. So thanks to everyone out there. The reason we're here, the reason why I was able to fly first class all the way over to London and stay in fancy hotels is because of the generosity of you Kickstarters. So thanks again. Now, Professor, we've talked about depictions of Haig. We've talked about depictions of generals. We've talked about the myths about how the war started. How about the depictions and descriptions of the Germans and in theory, the Austro-Hungarians? In the show, they really only talk about Germans.
That's right, yes. Beyond that, I think the one mention in the final episode about the causes of the war, I don't think there's any mention of Austria-Hungary. But there are regular references to the Hun. This is just trench language. The only actual engagement with a German is, apart from a possible German spy in the episode where Blackadder's in hospital for a while, the only actual engagement with a German is in the episode Private Plane, where Blackadder has briefly joined the Royal Flying Corps and he's brought down and he comes across the Red Baron von Richthofen. They call him von Richthofen with a V rather than Richthofen with an F.
The most famous German aviator during the war.
That's right. He's a comedy German.
Right.
He's not that far removed even from some of the Germans in that terrible series Hello, Hello, which I think is a dreadful parody of Secret Army, one of my all-time favourite TV programmes. But he's very much a comedy German. But I think in terms of values and the way Germans approach things, there's one revealing moment where Blackadder assumes that he's going to be executed. Mm-hmm. And Richthofen says, and I'm going to do this in the comedy German accent.
Yes. Oh, excellent.
Has to be understood. But instead, an even worse fate awaits you, so tomorrow you will be taken back to Germany. Blackadder says, here it comes. He says, to a convent school outside Heidelberg, where you spend the rest of the war teaching the young girls home economics. And Blackadder's confused by this, and Richthofen says, for you as a man of honour, the humiliation will be unbearable. So what they're presenting in this German that we meet is a standard comedy German stereotype of being bound by rules and bound by honour.
Mm-hmm.
But there's very little else on the Germans in this series.
I've sometimes wondered whether that may have been intentional or maybe even the unconscious coming through, because in the war, or at least where Blackadder and his troops are stationed, they're in trenches and the Germans are in trenches on the other side. And you don't, in theory, see them very much. Mm-hmm. Or you don't hear them and you don't make much contact with them even when you're fighting them. But was that even actually true?
Well, I think
that the one underground set of moles was fighting another underground set of moles.
No, not quite. You have to first of all remember that in 1914 and much of 1918, the war is very mobile. It's not trench warfare.
Right. Important myth.
You've got cavalry in use both at the beginning and end of the war and at various stages throughout. And we'll move on to where I actually would be very positive about the Blackadder portrayal.
Okay,
I think
good.
It's useful. What you see in Blackadder is they don't fight very often. And that's pretty accurate.
Right.
You're fighting, you know, there'll be infantry battalions, those who would be most likely to fight, who might only be advancing a couple of days a year.
Now, let me just repeat that for the buzzkillers out there. A couple of days a year.
Exactly. And they will be in the front line a lot of the rest of the time.
Yeah, frontline trenches.
Frontline trenches, but probably only on average 1 week every month. The rest of the time they're behind the lines.
Yeah. Rotated out.
Right, exactly. So you don't meet Germans very often.
Now, while they're not moving, so to speak, or at least as infantry not fighting, are these artillery barrages going on all the time?
Not all the time, no.
Right.
The bigger an artillery barrage, a very heavy artillery barrage, is going to be a prelude to an attempted advance by one side or the other. More common, the common dangers would be sniper fire.
Right.
But also smaller shell fire from essentially the equivalents of mortars.
Right.
When you're at the front line and not much is happening, it's you can't be sure you're safe.
Right.
You are in danger, but it's not happening all the time. And you're not living in trenches in the way that Blackadder suggests.
And other...
There are dugouts for officers to use, but the idea, for example, there's a suggestion in the final episode when they're talking about having run out of sugar. Bear in mind that this final episode is set in 1917.
Mm-hmm.
Baldrick actually says, we don't have any sugar. We ran out New Year's Eve 1915. As if they've been in that place since New Year's Eve 1915.
Right.
But this is nonsense because soldiers did not live in the trenches more than about 1 week every month.
That's very important.
And that was, this goes back to our earlier discussion about the generals. The generals knew people couldn't live in those, because in those conditions. Yeah. You know, people don't go and, in the Western world, go and live on campsites in general for years on end.
Right.
And we're talking about something far worse than a campsite, you know?
Right, right.
You are under fire. The conditions are dreadful. Infantry soldiers are generally at the front 1 week every month.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes less, sometimes a bit more, but that's what we think is a broad average.
Right.
And they're behind the lines the rest of the time. And actually, they have got things like sugar.
Right.
You're not running out of things 2 years ago.
But it also sounds like there must have been an awful lot of boredom.
I think that's absolutely right. I think what you have, the overwhelming emotion for the British soldier during the war is one of boredom.
Mm-hmm.
Tempered by moments of extreme fear.
Right.
But also tempered by other moments, time in the trenches when you're not attacking but might still be under fire, where there's a strong undercurrent of fear, mm-hmm. and uncertainty and stress. These are not pleasant places to be. The fact that they're only there 1 week every month is not to minimise the...
How bad it was.
The not so much the horror of it, but the extent to which you'd actually want to do it yourself. You wouldn't want to do it yourself. And you wouldn't want to send people you know there. This is an unpleasant experience. But you're not there all the time.
Right. And only 1 week in four, or 1 week in three, whatever it is completely different from the myth that we have.
Exactly.
That they get stuck in the trenches,
yeah.
and they're there for 4 years.
Exactly.
Which would be, they would die of madness.
You would.
What else about trench life in Blackadder is either mythological or is actually quite accurate?
I think some of the conversation about food,
mm-hmm.
particularly eating the rat in the episode of Captain Cook, where Baldrick offers Blackadder a choice of sautéed or fricasseed rat.
And they do it as in a waiter towards a customer,
exactly.
sort of thing. And it's
they
very...
do. They do. So Blackadder ends up saying, call me old Mr. Unadventurous, but I think I'll give it a miss this once. they weren't eating rat. You know, the provisions for the soldiers were not bad. Sometimes it was uh-huh. tinned. Sometimes it was, you know, the monotonous McConaughey stew. There were hard biscuits. Fresh water could be a problem sometimes,
mm-hmm.
But they boiled up. People were hardier, I think,
right.
than we are now, and had lower expectations.
Right.
This is one of the problems, actually, of people today engaging with stories of trench life. If you had come out of a slum in an inner city, the trenches may not, in some places, seem that different to home.
Right.
So obviously, a lot of people hadn't come out of slums, the
right.
majority of them. But people were hardier than we are now.
Well, on that note, let's take a break and hear from some of our partners at the Epicast Network.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Epicast Network show that you're listening to right now. Isn't it great?
Yeah. Come on. Thanks for listening to anything.
Exactly.
You could be listening to normal radio like a pap-pap, and you're not. You're listening not. To things on a computer like a grown person right now in 2015.
My God name is Sean Collier. This is my co-host, Aaron Kleiber.
Mm-hmm.
We have a movie review show. It's called You Can't Handle the Truth.
It's more than that, though. We get to be fun.
Yeah. It's about everything. But you know what we do? You know, there's a lot of movie reviews in the world. But a lot of those people, they don't know you. They can't relate to you.
And you know what their dreams were, like when they were in high school, was to go to NYU, and they didn't. And then they were like, I want to write for Rolling Stone. And guess what? They didn't. Now they have a blog on Tumblr.
Our dreams were to talk about movies to you. And we're living them.
We were those people that would sit around a TGI Fridays until 1 in the morning and get kicked out because we were sitting there talking about how Terminator 2 is so good. Okay, and we're those guys.
And now you can get in on that action.
Get in on that action.
We go to an advanced screening and we record as soon as we walk out of the theater. We don't stop to think about it and look up what Kurosawa would have done. We're just talking about it.
And bonus, we're moderately funny comedians who've had moderate success.
Exactly.
I don't know. You might be in for something good.
Get that every week on You Can't Handle the Truth, a proud part of the Epicast Network.
That was good, proud.
I think that was good.
Proud to be an American.
Listen to us now. Back to the show you chose to listen to.
And we're back. You know, one of the things that's so funny in Blackadder and is so... I wonder how telling it is about relations between soldiers. It is the relations between the officers and the enlisted men, because in the main part of Blackadder, you have two officers and you have one enlisted man. And then occasionally other enlisted people show up. But it's very, very top-heavy, very top-down. How close is that correspond to reality?
We should clear up some of the terminology, which may be British and American differences over
officers
and enlisted, because Blackadder is actually a professional soldier, but the lieutenant is an enlisted soldier. He's someone who volunteered, and we would use enlisting to indicate volunteering. Baldrick also is an enlisted man. But let's also remember that there were a large number of conscripts, men who were from 1916 onwards forced to go into the into the British Army.
Okay, so the British, when someone enlists or volunteers and becomes an officer, they're called enlisted officers. Whereas in the American Army, enlisted men are the privates. And
Well, we would tend not to use enlisted to describe a type of soldier.
Okay.
It would be an act.
The act of
enlisting means you're enlisted. But the language we would use is officers, NCOs, non-commissioned officers, mm-hmm. and other ranks or private soldiers.
Okay.
The ordinary soldier is a private soldier.
Okay.
The corporals.
Meaning the rank of private.
Exactly. The corporals up to... different types of corporals and sergeants and non-commissioned officers.
Okay.
And then you have officers from second lieutenant upwards.
Right.
But we would talk about second lieutenants and lieutenants as, I suppose, junior officers.
Right.
Captains and majors a bit more senior than that, but they are very much in the front line. And lieutenant colonels as well are usually with their battalion quite close to the front.
Hmm.
A battalion being about 1,000 men. But Blackadder does show interaction between all ranks in different ways. Mm-hmm. You know, it's relatively low budget and small cost, and they can't show the full range of things. But I think the extent to which relationships develop, even between... a captain and a private serving under him, that they would get to know somebody. Obviously, Baldrick essentially has a role as Blackadder's Batman in some way. You know,
By the way, we need a translation for that.
Yeah, he's not a superhero. He's a valet, essentially. Or that may also need translating.
Yeah, no, we would know a valet. He's a personal servant.
Personal servant, exactly. So Blackadder portrays that And I think the camaraderie that's there, that you see between the men, the camaraderie of the soldiers, especially in the final episode, when Captain Darling, who is someone who's not been presented in an especially favourable manner in much of the series, is goes over the top with them, and they welcome him, and you know he shows some courage in doing what he feels to be his duty.
Yeah, let's talk about that last scene, because what happens, for those of you who haven't seen it, is most of the major characters go over the top, and in World War One language, that means coming out of the trenches and charging toward the enemy trenches. And it's a very poignant, they filmed it in an obviously choreographed it very, very poignant way, because, you know, they go into slow motion, they have, you know, sort of dreamy music, and they're all running and firing at the same time. And you assume that they're about to get mowed down by the Germans, and that this is the great tragedy of the war, that the futility of it all. How close to the truth is that sort of depiction?
It's become very fashionable to knock Blackadder in its entirety. Revisionist historians do this, although lots of people like Dan Todman have written about areas in which it still has a value. There was a big national debate about this a couple of years ago when Michael Gove, then the Secretary of State for Education, said that, well, Blackadder's all that people are being taught in schools, and there's a conspiracy by left-wing historians to pursue a sort of semi-pacifist agenda,
right,
and an agenda that's very critical of the war. He then, and this is where he hadn't done his research, he then went on to cite Gary Sheffield.
The historian Gary Sheffield,
who's the leading revisionist in lots of ways, as being someone who's put people right on this. He hadn't bothered to inquire into Gary's politics. And, you know, Gary's somebody who left the Labour Party over the Iraq War or, you know, around that time, and voted Liberal Democrat when he thought that the Lib Dems were left of Labour.
Right, so he's more left than he's been.
Exactly, and, you know, would be very much a left of centre person. So that was just typical Michael Gove in lots of ways. Now, around that time, I'd written and co-authored an article with Dan Jarvis, the Labour MP who is Labour's lead on the centenary commemorations. And we'd actually said in that that what Blackadder does, and we were thinking of this final scene, is display in a poignant, thought-provoking way, the loss that people suffered in the First World War.
Right.
And Dan is an former member of the Parachute Regiment, so he knows all about being in action. We then went on to say, but if people only get Blackadder, then that's a problem. But what we were trying to do there was state that Blackadder has a value.
Right.
And this is where the poets have a value. Mm-hmm. In understanding some of the emotions.
Right.
And you have to accept, I think, that although that final scene is shot in a particular way, and there's a danger if it's taken as being representative of every military campaign, nevertheless, those things happened.
Yes,
there were men who went over the top and were mown down in large numbers. And this this debate about Blackadder has caused me to reflect on what might be the dangers of revisionist history being fully accepted by everyone as all there is to say.
Right.
If we ended up with a view of the First World War that went something like this, that Britain was right to engage in it, that we had justified reasons for doing so, that although there were failures in the way the war was fought, essentially the British military and its allies brought the war to a successful conclusion.
Right.
If that was the view that we were left with, I think we would have lost something quite serious from the fact that a lot of the criticisms by, I suppose, people like Ramsay MacDonald about the outbreak of the war, those who went into the Union of Democratic Control, who criticised the way British foreign policy operated, a lot of those criticisms were justified, and that it would have been possible to avoid the war if people had realised what it would become. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a war that people actually wanted. And to that extent, I think the war remains a tragedy.
Right.
The losses there were avoidable. They were caused, I think, more by politicians' mistakes at the outbreak than by military failures, who, after all, in democracies, are at the behest of the politicians. So although I'm someone who completely subscribes to revisionist arguments about what trench life was really like, things I've talked about today, about the learning curve, and so on, I do think we need to reflect on what might be lost if we lose all of the tragedy argument. And I think it's incumbent on all of us to remember that men were killed in this war in very large numbers. And Blackadder is a portrayal of some of that. You know, it's a truth of the war. There are lots of other truths, but this is indisputable.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. This has been a wonderful episode. We've learned not only so much detail about the war and so many new things about the war in terms of what most people think. We've busted a number of myths, but also done exactly what I wanted this show to do, which is to use the myths to broaden out the historical understanding of these very important events that have been skewed in one way or another. So, thanks again.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
We'll talk to you next time, Buzzkillers.
Epicast.